With the power invested in me by the state of Oklahoma as the chairman of the University of Oklahoma Board of Regents, on behalf of my fellow regents, the University of Oklahoma community, and the people of Oklahoma, I charge you to maintain the trust of all those who have come before us. I charge you to give of yourself and your talent to preserve and strengthen this great institution and to lead our faculty, students, staff, and alumni as one community, united in the pursuit of excellence.
Mr. Chairman, I deeply believe that there is no higher duty in life than stewardship, and that we have no greater mission as a people than the education, mentoring, and nurturing of the next generation. This is a great institution, worthy of the same kind of love and commitment that were given to it by its early leaders, who settled for no small dreams, no limited vision, and no standard short of the highest. I can think of no greater privilege, in sunshine or in rain, than to have the opportunity to lead this community of outstanding faculty, students, and staff in a place that means so much to me and to my family. Mr. Chairman, with profound humility, but with great enthusiasm and confidence in our future, I accept your charge and I accept the responsibilities of the presidency of the University of Oklahoma.
That was David Boren as he became the 13th president of the University of Oklahoma in November 1994. A graduate of Yale University, Boren was Phi Beta Kappa and Rhodes Scholar before receiving his law degree from OU in 1968. Just 6 years later, as a member of the legislature, he was elected governor of Oklahoma. In 1978, voters sent him to the United States Senate. After 16 years in Washington, Boren left the Senate to succeed Richard Van Horn as OU president, a position he held for almost 24 years. Boren's tenure as OU president capped a long career in public service that has spanned 51 years. This is Dick Pryor. Over the next hour, I speak with David Boren about the university, public service, and his legacy in a conversation with David Boren.
You've probably been asked so much. So what have you not been asked?
I have been asked so many questions, but I've said a couple of things that I really hope will come out in some of these interviews that I've been doing. And one of them is the overwhelming feeling that I've had, Dick, is a feeling of gratitude. I mean, there's just been, and there are not enough opportunities and not enough ways in which I can say thank you to basically the people of Oklahoma. They've been giving me every opportunity in my life that I hoped that I could have. They've let me be a legislator and a governor and a senator, and now, of course, the most rewarding of all, president of the University of Oklahoma. So they've just given me such gifts to be in a position to serve in ways that have so much meaning and so much purpose. And when I was, I've only kept a diary 1 year in my life, which I wrote in it every day, every morning or every evening. And that's when I was at Oxford. I was about maybe 20 years old, and I kept a diary, and it's still under lock and key. I've not shown it all to my wife or best friend or anyone else. It's still mainly my own resource. But in my diary, at one point in time, I wrote down the things I hoped I could do in my life, and I what my dreams were. And I said, I hoped that I would have the chance to be a U.S. Senator from Oklahoma. That was something that I really wanted to do. My father had been in politics. I saw that as a way of service. I saw that as a way of helping build a greater state. I wrote that down. I didn't write, I hoped I could be governor. I just sort of got mad enough along the way that I ran for governor to try to straighten things out. And I saw corruption and other things happening that I thought needed to be changed. So I ran with a broom and a clean sweep campaign. That was not really that wasn't really intended when I was writing in my diary. The other thing I wrote in my diary was that someday I hoped I would get to be president of the University of Oklahoma. I hoped I would have that opportunity. So when you think back about that, because I had watched Dr. Cross, I'd watched the way he made a difference, I thought about my own life and great teachers, great educators at all levels, starting with my first grade teacher and my high school English teacher and so many other people had made such a huge difference in my life that I saw that as a way to serve. I realized that public service wasn't about power. Public service was about service. Where could you do the most good? And so being president of the University of Oklahoma was something that had always been in the back of my mind. And when the Regents contacted me and said the position's open and it wasn't a convenient time, I had two more years left in my U.S. Senate term, I had to resign early to come home to do it. I went back and I reread that section of my diary, and I'm sure those thoughts of making a difference in the right way and investing your life in the next generation in a place you love, all of that kind of resonated with me. So Dick, I've been able to really live out my dreams, the dreams and hopes I had for my life when I was 19, 20 years old. That's the life I've been able to live. So how can you be filled with anything but gratitude when you've had the chance to realize those dreams that you had as a young person?
In 1994, you said your first goal as president would be to build a strong sense of community.
Yes.
How did you do?
Well, I feel really good about the community, the sense of community and family that we have on this campus now. I think that we do care about each other. We respect each other. Diversity has become a real strength of our family and our community. And I had last night a discussion with some of our freshmen in our president's leadership class. And I asked them, I said, how do you think you have changed most during your first year in college? I said, I look back on it and I think that might have been the year in which I grew more as a person than any other time in my life, because so many new experiences and new exposure to things and making your own decisions. And you know, it was very interesting to listen to them. Nearly every one of them said, I think I grew the most by being exposed to people that are not like me. People who came from had a different racial background, a different religious background, maybe a different economic status, learning what their needs were, learning what their thoughts were, what they've learned from their experience. I've grown so much by exposure to other people who are not like myself. And, you know, I said, well, I hope that leads you to understand then when I say diversity is essential for a university community. I'm not being politically correct. I'm not saying that as a slogan. It's really true, because I think you do grow. You don't grow when you just stick around with people who've had the same life experiences, the same ideas, don't ever challenge your thinking. You don't ever grow until you're exposed to people from other backgrounds. And so it was a joy to me to hear that. And so I said, diversity, it's not a slogan. It's an integral part of building educational excellence, because you grow intellectually when you are exposed to others unlike yourself. So making diversity a strength of the university, learning how to respect others from different places, different backgrounds, caring for them. I think that's a contribution to the whole country. What worries me most about America today, and if you were to ask me how could you make America great again or greater, I would say I'm most concerned about the fragmentation, the splintering in our society, the polarization of our society, the divisions that have grown up in our society. We've always been able to meet any challenge when we were able to unite as Americans, those who hold the same basic values, although we may be of different backgrounds or different races, but we've come together because we share the same bedrock American values, and we've been able to meet those challenges. And we need to produce citizens who will go out wherever they live and create that sense of community, that sense of family wherever they live. And how are they going to do that if they've not really experienced it? So creating a wonderful sense of community and family and mutual respect and civility and sharing of ideas and thoughts, even when they're different thoughts, is so important. And that's one of the things I think the university can do. Send out citizens who've experienced this kind of community, who've built that kind of community where they've gone to their universities, and send them out to create communities all across this country. And I really feel good that we're in the process of doing that.
Throughout your career, you've been a consensus builder. First Lady Molly Shiborin has been quoted as saying that you are a visionary and an implementer. What is your formula for turning vision into reality?
Well, I think first of all is making sure that you get the help of a lot of other people. You can have, and the president of the University of Oklahoma, for example, is one of the most fortunate people alive, because think of how many free, non-paid, brilliant consultants you have. People with new ideas, people with creative ideas. Think about the intellectual firepower of this campus, or this faculty, or this staff, or of our students. Think about all of this, all of the ideas, all of the creativity, the vision that comes from all of them. So one of the first things is to listen, to be collaborative, to realize that a university is a place where you can draw upon all of that talent and all of that, those ideals and all of that energy to get done what you hope can get done. And so forming a vision is a process of listening to a lot of other people, sharing their best ideas, refining those ideas, adding your own ideas along into the mix. And then one of the great joys has been, if you are the executive, you do then have the ability to get those ideas put in place. So if you have the idea of an honors college, let's say, where we're going to take, we have all these incredibly bright students. We're number one in the nation in National Merit Scholars coming to our campus. We have a moral obligation to develop all of that potential and make sure that it gets developed to the fullest. So creating an honors college, a college within the university where students can have small classes of 18 or less, intensive classes, where they are really the best and brightest are really being challenged, it's an important thing to do. You can have that concept, and that's a concept that came not from me, but from people who taught in the honors program, people who have been in admissions, people all across the university. But then you have the ability to say, okay, let's do it. Let's create it. So you can have ideas. I was talking to a journalist this morning, and I laughed because I said, it's so different than he said, how do you compare it to the Washington experience? I said, well, because usually in Washington, they're still dealing with, I could still go back to the Senate today, and I wouldn't even have to make new preparations. They're still debating the same topics. They've never reached a decision on the same important issues. They're still working on it. I remember the first week I was here, one of the things I noticed on the campus, I noticed all the fire plugs around campus were rusty and dirty looking, and they didn't look good. And so I said to our physical facilities people, I said, our painters, I said, I'd like to get as quickly as possible, I'd like for you to repaint all the fire plugs on campus red and white as soon as you can do it. Well, it was amazing, because literally within 2 days, every fire plug on this campus was brightly colored red and white, and they had gone beyond the boundaries of the university, and I found them all the way down almost to the Methodist Church painting the city fire plugs red and white. And I said, stop, you've gone too far. But that's just an example. You have the satisfaction of seeing an idea, or just anything, big or small, creating a new honors college to painting the fire plugs. You can get those things done. You have the ability to get it done and get it done quickly. And so there's almost an immediate feedback to the ideas that you have.
During your tenure at OU, the university has raised more than $3 billion. And that money has been needed because state funding has been cut over time. In three of your 4 years as governor, Oklahoma led the nation in the percentage increase in funding for common and higher education. Why is education not a higher priority today, and how does education get more funding?
Dick, I've asked myself that same question so many times. How could that be? Has the climate changed so much in Oklahoma? Did Oklahomans stop caring about educating the next generation? Did they stop understanding that our need to educate and draw out all the potential of the next generation is one of our first responsibilities as parents, as citizens, as grandparents? How did it happen that we allowed ourselves to have thousands of children now in the classrooms with people that weren't trained as teachers? How did it happen that we have four-day school weeks? How did all of these things happen? How did it happen that we're running the University of Oklahoma today in terms of state funding? If we just had to depend upon the state, we're receiving less than we did 20 years ago. And yet we have thousands of more students. We have new programs, new opportunities. We're doing so many things that we weren't doing 20 years ago. And how did this happen? And I think a lot of it is And I can say this now that I'm no longer in day-to-day active politics, but it's a failure of political leadership. I think one of the great duties of a political leader is to educate people, the public, about things they really need to know, to appeal to the best instincts, not the worst instincts, not the most selfish instincts. It doesn't take much political talent to go around to people saying, how would you like a tax cut? How would you like to keep more money in your pocket? Those are things that people love to hear. But do they know that we're doing that at the expense of not providing health care or mental health care or education for the next generation or the kinds of colleges and universities we need? We need political leadership that will educate the people to the truth. The truth is there's no free lunch. And yes, I'm against government waste. I actually, when I was governor, cut taxes. Up to that time, it was the largest tax cut in state history. But we had surpluses. We were able to do that and still meet our responsibilities, still be in the top three or four or five in the nation in increases for education, for example. But we've cut our taxes at a time we've been in deficit. We've cut our taxes when we were not adequately funding basic state services. And I'm the first one to be against government waste and unnecessary red tape and all the rest of it. But we're like a private business. You have to invest in essentials or you just don't have a future. And if you don't invest in educating the next generation, education and in healthcare and in things that are so fundamental, you don't have the quality of life in your state that will attract other people to come or those best and brightest and most capable people in your state to stay. And that worries me greatly. And I wish I knew a way to turn that around. I tried to pass a state question for an extra penny for education in our state, and we got more signatures on the petition than any other petition in state history. But then when the time came, we were overwhelmed by, I think, a national political wave, plus we had some of our own people and even some in the business community running ads on television saying, don't pass this, let the legislature solve this problem, it's their problem. Well, they haven't solved the problem, and we've seen what's happened. I do think we're almost there. I think we have hit such rock bottom, and it's been such a shock. We're proud people. I'm very proud to be an Oklahoman. I don't ever like it when I hear, oh, you're first in teen pregnancy, or you're first in health problems, or mental health problems, and you're last, dead last in what you spend per child to educate children in your state. Don't you care about children? I mean, it really makes me mad as an Oklahoman, because I'm proud of our state. I think our people really, when our people get all the facts and they get fully educated, I think our people are very caring. We're among the top five states. We have been for years, and what we give charitably of our time and of our means, and reaching out to help other people when they're victimized by tornadoes and disasters, the people of Oklahoma have that pioneer spirit of helping each other, and it's up to our leadership to make the right kind of appeals to educate us, to educate. And I think we have a huge job still ahead of us of making sure that people see it. But I think they're now shocked enough that we are, when you have newspapers in England, for example, headlining our state and talking about it as a failed state, and you have the young people in our state asking the question, which I get all the time, should we stay here? We want to live in a place where our children have good schools to go to and where we have an economic future. Should we stay in the state that's not investing in itself? Not investing in us? Those are tough questions, but I think we're at the point. We're at a turning point in our state, and I think the fact that we just saw, and it's only a beginning, the first repair to our revenue streams in 28 years or so, it's a good sign. It's some light at the end of the tunnel, so I still have to try to be an optimist, and being around these young people at our university every day makes me an optimist about the future, that we're going to turn this around.
I'm Dick Pryor, and you're listening to my conversation with former OU President David Boren. After the break, I asked David Boren about his time as U.S. Senator and why he departed the Senate with 2 years left in his term to become president of OU. I'm Dick Pryor, and today on the Sunday Radio Matinee, we hear from David Boren, who served as the University of Oklahoma's 13th president from 1994 to 2018. Before being selected president of OU, Boren was a highly respected member of the United States Senate. He was known for bipartisanship, a consensus builder. Boren was an expert on foreign affairs and chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. But Boren saw collegiality in the Senate eroding. In 1984, he said members of the Senate were behaving like kids arguing on the schoolyard. It was a sign of things to come for the nation and hinted at a change in Boren's future. David Boren's book, A Letter to America, was released in 2008. That year, he appeared on C-SPAN's Washington Journal with host Rob Harleston to discuss the book and its message.
Joining us now is former Senator David Boren, who has a new book out called A Letter to America. I'm going to read from the introduction in just a few seconds. But, sir, what is it that worries you most about America today?
Rob, I guess it is the fact that we don't seem to believe in ourselves the way we used to. You know, one of the things that caused me to finally sit down and write this book, which is literally a letter to the American people in the form of a letter, was reading a poll that said that two-thirds of the American people do not believe that our future is going to be as great as our past. And when I read that, I wanted to shout out, that's un-American. That's not who we are. We're defined always by our optimism. And historians and sociologists tell us that you can measure the strength of a society about how optimistic people are about their future. And for every straight generation in succession, we've been able to leave this country a little bit better for our children than it was found, with a little more opportunity for our children. And when I saw that, I thought, this is something that means we must engage in a national conversation to get our confidence back and to take care of those things that have made us so pessimistic.
This is the part of the introduction of your book, A Letter to America. You write, "The history of our country demonstrates that we Americans are natural problem solvers. Again and again, we have come to understand the problems we face. We have come together to find a way to solve them. Our greatest leaders have not met the challenges and solved these problems by themselves. These leaders," and it goes on to the next page, "these leaders were..."
When you left the Senate, you were very influential. Your approval rating was 91%. People were talking about the possibility of a run for president of the United States. But you said the Senate had changed. It had become more partisan, more contentious. It was not the same Senate that you had entered. Do you still see those elements of decline? And do you think your solutions still apply?
I was very concerned when I wrote the letter to America, and if I was concerned then, I'm almost twice as concerned now. We have to rebuild a sense of a spirit of bipartisanship in this country, where we, even if we have differences of opinion, we try to reach consensus and we finally move forward. We still need to do that. One of the things I suggested was that the President of the United States, when you have a new proposal, let's say about healthcare or about education or about immigration or things that really matter, bring the key leaders of Congress in those fields, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, who are the powerful members of the most important committees, let's say about economic policy or educational policy. Bring them to the White House and sit down around the table and really work out a bipartisan compromise in advance before you announce it. Because once you go out and announce, here's my proposal, or here's the Republican proposal, or here's the Democratic proposal, now I expect the other side to get on board. That's not the way to get consensus. You need to work on consensus at the front end so that you come out and say, here are a group of us. This is not a finished product, but it's a beginning. It's a bipartisan beginning. Both parties have had input into this. So we ask you to join in this bipartisan effort to solve our health care problems, our other essential problems of our society, or more opportunity for those kids who grow up in the bottom quartile economically to go on and get a college education.
Or campaign finance reform.
Or campaign finance reform. I mean, I suppose if you said, is there one thing that you felt that you had not left undone when you left the Senate, it was campaign finance reform. We got so close. I tried to do something to turn off the flood tide of special interest money that was flowing into all these campaigns. And so many candidates getting most of their money not from people in their home states or their home districts, but from political action committees and special interest groups. And, you know, that's done more than anything, I think, to drive a wedge between of distrust between the people and their own representatives than anything else.
Shortly before leaving the U.S. Senate in 1994, David Boren spoke on the Senate floor about the need for campaign finance reform and what he saw as declining civility and bipartisanship.
The senator from Oklahoma is recognized.
Mr. President, I yield myself 10 minutes. Mr. President, I have listened with great interest to my colleague from the other side of the aisle describe what this debate is all about. And once again, I must admit that had I not known in advance the subject we were discussing, I would not have recognized that we were debating a bill for campaign finance reform that will finally give power back to the American people by limiting the amount of money that can be spent on campaigns and allow broader participation. It is true that the confidence of the American people in this institution is at an all-time low. As I said yesterday, I have pondered many times why people have lost confidence in this institution and what I could do as an individual member of this institution, because we're all trustees of this great institution through which the American people are meant to have an opportunity to be represented and to express their views about important matters impacting our future. I've reflected with great intensity, particularly because in a very few weeks I will walk out of this chamber for the last time, not to return to it as a voting member of this Senate. It's been a great privilege to serve here. These desks, these offices, do not belong to us, they belong to the people. And the relationship of trust between the American people and their own government has been strained and frayed as never before in this century. The latest polling data indicates that only 14% of the American people have confidence in this institution. And I will leave it with great sadness. We, as trustees of this institution, have not done what we should do to restore public confidence.
It wasn't a partisan issue at all. It was an issue of trying to save the system. Several of us worked together. I think about them often. Senator Byrd of West Virginia, who was the Democratic leader, he had came and had different positions than I had on many issues. Senator Goldwater was the first co-sponsor. We had a Boren-Goldwater bill. He was one of the first people to step up and want to help me reform the process. And after he died, John McCain. We all worked so hard on it and got so close, but fortunately we never got it across the finish line. That problem's still there to be addressed.
This is Dick Pryor, and you're listening to my conversation with former University of Oklahoma President David Boren. When we come back, David Boren discusses his tenure as president and a critical moment that made headlines around the world. From state legislator to governor, U.S. Senator to President of the University of Oklahoma, David Boren has dedicated his life to public service. Along with First Lady Molly Shy Boren, during his more than two decades as OU president, David Boren guided the university through unprecedented growth and a period of heightened national reputation. I'm Dick Pryor, and in the final segment of A Conversation with David Boren, we talk about a defining moment in his presidency and what's next as he hands the reins of the university to his successor, James Gallagly. Your presidency has been marked by outstanding accomplishments, initiating more than 30 new programs. What's been the most difficult challenge or difficult moment you had to face in 24 years as president?
Well, I think the most difficult moment was the surfacing of the racist video, which went viral all across, really around the world, not just across the country.
It's the caught on camera moment that is raising questions about race and privilege on a college campus in the American South.
Outrage continues over the University of Oklahoma Sigma Alpha Epsilon racist chant video.
Your name from a tree, better never saw me.
Announced a short while ago on President David Boren's Twitter account in the last handful of minutes. He says he's taken action expelling two students who played a leadership role in this racist
A stern message from the University of Oklahoma president to the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity after a racist video surfaced of chanting members using the N-word.
That was the most difficult moment. I was called from a dinner table with four Pulitzer Prize winning historians who were here to lecture the next day in one of our teach-ins on American history, and called to the kitchen and shown that video on a handheld device. And at first, I was just in shock. I didn't believe it. I first said, "Are you sure these are OU students? These couldn't be. This is a throwback for years. These are kinds of things that just don't happen anymore, and especially here. And we don't believe in it." And I said, "So find out, are these our students?" And I said, "As soon as I know, I'll tell you. I already have reached my decision. We're going to close the organization. We're going to take action against those responsible. We're not going to put up with it on our campus." And people were saying, "Oh, are you sure? Now you might be sued. You might be this could happen or that could happen. You could lose donations. Other things could happen." I said, "I don't care. You know, right's right and wrong's wrong. This is wrong. We cannot put up with this." So the decision was reached maybe in 5 minutes. And I quoted the late Mrs. Fred Jones, Marietta Jones. When I first came here, she was a very important advisor to me. And one of the things she said to me was, "Do right and fear not." She said, "If you'll just remember that over and over again, do right and fear not, you'll make the right decisions." And so when I was immediately confronted with that, even as I still stood in the kitchen, and looking at that on a telephone, that video, I kept hearing her voice: "Do right and fear not. Do right." And I knew what was right, and I knew what was wrong. I knew that was wrong. I knew it was contrary to everything we stood for. And so I called our dean of students. First of all, I told him what action I was taking, and I said, "I understand the students are going to march in the morning." And there were thousands of our students out when it was still dark, marching on the North Oval. And I said, "I haven't been invited to attend, but I'm going to attend." And he said, "What do you need?" I said, "I need a bullhorn so that I can speak to that crowd and tell them what we're going to do and that we're not going to put up with that." And they were marching to say, and I was so inspired by their actions, they were marching to say, really with a single voice, "Not on our campus."
I want you all to know, and I think it's very important, and I've heard you've been chanting, "Not on our campus." We're in a very delicate period all across our country. It's not just here at our campus, it's everywhere. People seem to feel some kind of permission to start spewing this kind of talk, to preach hatred, to preach division, at a time that if we ever needed to be together and be strong, it's now.
That was so inspiring, and I had a chance to say to them, "I'm with you. I'm a part of what you're saying. We're all going to say this. We're going to say this to the whole world." And in the next 24 hours, I did interviews with more than 60 major news organizations, cable channels, network channels, not only in the United States, but BBC and Le Monde and other outlets of other media in the world, Western world, and particularly, and to send the message, we're not putting up with that. That's not the kind of university we are. That's not what we stand for. We stand for something else. And as a result, what was, I think, the worst moment, and it inflicted so much pain on so many people in our university community, it became, in a way, something, we turned something that was so negative into something positive because we dealt with it right away. We showed we understood the difference between right and wrong and that we were going to act on what we thought was right. And so what happened? Compared to, say, some other universities in our regions that had racial incidents, one of our neighboring universities lost almost a third of its enrollment. They've had to close dorms. Their minority enrollment has really plunged. Well, since that incident, our minority enrollment has gone up. Our total enrollment has gone up. I think the strength of our family has gotten greater because we've worked so hard at it. We've realized we can't leave anything to chance that something like that could happen here. So, and I've had students say, I came here because OU, I didn't want to go to a racist university, and OU sent such a loud, clear signal, we'll never put up with that.
And OU had a sketchy history in terms of
yes.
Our
history was not the best. I mean, we started out as an all-white institution for many years, and a lot of very brave and courageous people caused that to change. And I feel so privileged because I got to know Ada Lois Sophia Fisher, for example, mm-hmm. who was one of the first African-American students here. We have a fountain named for her on the campus. We've honored her in many ways. And she played such an important role. I got to know her early on when she'd gone to be a professor at Langston, and she's been an inspirational figure in my life. I think that the hopes that people like Ada Lois and Clara Looper and others who were early students of color at the University of Oklahoma, the hopes they had that we could build a true community in which diversity is our strength, I think we've realized a lot of those goals.
As your tenure as president is winding down, what is the biggest thing left undone or incomplete?
Well, I think the biggest thing left undone is really state funding, restoring our state funding base. To one newspaper recently, I described it as, I think we're the strongest we've ever been as a university. We have the strongest faculty, just think, going from 94 endowed chairs and professorships to 580 privately funded, that we could provide extra funds to get the best and brightest here and keep them here. So our faculty's never been stronger. Our students, number one in the nation in National Merit Scholars, the only university in American history whose students, any university in American history, not Harvard, not Yale, not MIT, not Stanford, whose students won all of the six major national scholarships in 1 year. It's the University of Oklahoma. Our student body, we've increased the admission standards twice during the time that I've been here. We've quadrupled scholarships to go after students of talent who didn't have the means to come, and we've been able to open those opportunities for them. So in one sense, the university has never been stronger, and that was my ambition. I wanted to step down with the university as strong as it's ever been in its history, and I think it is. But we're like a very strong figure standing on the edge of a cliff. And that cliff is the lack of state funding. We've talked already, when you're only receiving a little less than you did 20 years ago, and we've led the nation, number one in the nation, in cuts to higher education, you know, how long can we be at the top and in the top universities in the country in private giving? We're so close to being able to raise as much money, say, as the University of Texas, which is also in the top 10. But just think, they're three times as big as we are. Think mm-hmm. about the size of the state of Texas and the wealth that's in the state of Texas. How long can we, a small state, relatively small university, how long can we raise the same kind of total dollars? How long can we raise the amount of money a year per year that adds up to $3 billion over 20 years? How long can we do that? At some point, the pockets run dry, and people, you can only go back to the same people, and they can only give their sacrificial gifts one time or two times. They can't keep doing that, and I really worry about it. What will happen to the excellence of this university if we do not turn around the concept of the state's responsibility? When I was governor, we got up to over 50%. We paid over 50% of the cost of sending a student to a university like the University of Oklahoma. Now it's down around 11 or 12%. How far is it going to go? I mean, we've got to turn that around. We've got to realize that it's not just in the interest of that one set of parents or that one student who gets to come to the University of Oklahoma. Yes, it changes their lives. It changes their ability to earn income. It changes the kind of future they'll have. But it's a public good. It's not just a private good. It's important for the whole state that we educate all of that talent, and all of our students get that opportunity. And I've said so often, you can't have a great state if you don't have a great university within it.
Thinking about your remarkable career in public service, college professor, legislator, governor, U.S. senator, president of the University of Oklahoma, What do you consider yourself to be?
Well, I guess, and probably when I first got here, I'm sure it would have shocked the faculty to get this answer. But in my heart and in my soul, what really drives me more than anything else is being an educator and being a teacher and trying to bring out the talents and to develop the talents in other people. And there is no joy like the joy of seeing a young person who comes with all of this raw talent and this ability to see them grow, to see them mature, to see that talent be developed, to see them go out and be such successful citizens and great parents and great leaders in their communities. There's just no satisfaction like that satisfaction. And yes, I've been a politician. Yes, I've been in politics. I've done other things. But deep down, I think that what drives me most is the desire to be an educator and touch the lives of other people, and especially touch the lives of young people and give them the kind of opportunities that I've been given.
What do you think will be your most long-lasting legacy?
I think, and this is something I've tried to do with in the way I've lived my life and the way I've been president of the university and the kind of messages I've sent out. And they asked me what I wanted to have written on the base of the statue that they're going to put up on me on campus. It's kind of embarrassing to think of a statue of yourself being where you can see it. I wouldn't let them do it while I was here as president, but they're going to put up a statue. And I said, well, I want you to write on the bottom of it something that I've tried to say to our students. Never underestimate the power of kindness. The way we treat each other is going to do more to determine our future than anything else. I think that helps build the bonds. It helps build the spirit of community that we so badly need in our country today. And so that, I hope, will be my parting word, is don't forget how important kindness is. Don't forget how important it is to treat each other in the right way.
Boren reinforced the importance of kindness during one of his last public acts as president, when he delivered the commencement address to the OU graduating class of 2018.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you tonight your commencement speaker for the class of 2018. Your commencement speaker really needs no introduction. He spent the last 24 years making the University of Oklahoma what it is. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 13th president of the University of Oklahoma, President David L. Boren.
Thank you very much for that understated introduction, Dean Stroud. Members of the graduating class, the ultimate well-being and strength of our society, I do not believe, is ultimately measured by our military strength or our economic strength. It is measured by the way we treat each other. That is what makes us a truly great and strong society. Thank you for creating an atmosphere of kindness on our campus. That is the real Sooner magic. The way we treat each other and feel about each other on our campus is truly unique, and you are the reason for it. Do not let the passing of time or changing circumstances change the person you are now. Do not stop being an idealist. Keep inspiring others with your ideals and your calls to action. Even when it is socially more convenient to remain silent in the face of intolerance or the demeaning of others, continue to speak up against it. Only then can we make racism and intolerance socially unacceptable. Do not compromise your personal integrity for false ideas of success. Wherever you live, keep on creating a true sense of community. Continue to have the courage to build real friendships, as you have here. Go with your moral courage intact and with the determination to make a difference in the lives of others. This is a university where each member of the OU family is invested in the success of every other member. Just think what it would mean to the entire country if we could spread that attitude all across America. And it begins right here with you.
What do you want people to say about David L. Boren? that hasn't already been said?
Oh, I don't know. They've said about everything you could think of. Some of those things I try to forget. I don't know that I treated others as I wanted to be treated myself. I mean, that's kind of going back to what I just said about kindness, that I tried to bring out the best in other people, and that it wasn't about me. It wasn't about my ego or my title. It was about where did I think I could do the most good. And I hope they'll remember me for that, as a person that just tried to make things a little bit better for other people. You know, in the end, you're not remembered by your own accomplishments or what you do for yourself or any titles you get to yourself. You're really remembered, you're really judged, finally, I think, on what kind of impact do you have on the lives of other people. And I think that's how I want to be remembered, for the impact that I hopefully have had on the lives of other people, not for what I've done for David Boren or what titles I've amassed or anything else or honors I've received, but what have I done for other people? I hope I'll be found worthy to be judged in that way.
And an Oklahoman.
And an Oklahoman, absolutely. You know, Oklahoma, and I guess maybe people from other places don't feel the same way, but to me, Oklahoma has been important to me all of my life, and I've been proud to be a part of this society. I'm so proud of the good qualities of our people in this state, and proud of the fact that we do give back more than others, and so many things. It's such a special place that my ambition has always been to give back to Oklahoma, and I suppose sometimes if I had to pick between what I thought was representing the people of Oklahoma and what I thought might have been politically advisable in terms of national political trends, I've always made my choice to try to represent Oklahoma and to be a representative of the best of what Oklahoma stands for wherever I've been, whether it's been in the Senate, whether it's been abroad at Oxford, wherever it's been. I've always been really proud to say right off the bat, I'm an Oklahoman.
Have you thought about what it's going to feel like when you walk out of Boyd House for the last time as president?
Oh, I try not to think about that, because it's been, you know, it's been our home for 24 years. Molly really helped with all the restoration of Boyd House. We raised the private funds. She made the decisions about furnishing it and decorating it. It's truly been our home, as well as being the president's house at the University of Oklahoma. So it will be hard to leave that place. It'll be hard to leave this office, the president's office, where I've spent so many hours. But you know, you have seasons in your life, and I'm just, as I've said, I think the luckiest person around, because first of all, I've gotten to live out so many of my dreams that I had as a young man. And now, at this season of my life, I get to do something that I love above all else, teaching, getting to be with students, getting to share their hopes and their dreams, and hopefully encourage their hopes and dreams. And who could have a better life than that?
What's next for you? You could run for governor again.
No. I think that those days of that kind of political activity are over. So what's next is trying to be something that I honor so much, trying to be a great teacher, aspiring to be a great teacher, spending my time, investing my life in the lives of these young people here in a new and maybe an even deeper way than I've been able to do, because I've had all the duties of the president's office as well. So shedding those duties, having the freedom to set my own priorities and to serve maybe in a more intensive way with our students, I really look forward to that.
President Boren, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick.
David Boren retired as OU president on June 30th, 2018. He has called his time as president of the university the most rewarding period of his life. A Conversation with David Boren is a production of KGOU Radio. This program includes audio segments courtesy of C-SPAN and the University of Oklahoma. I'm Dick Pryor. Thank you for listening to A Conversation with David Boren.